听力课堂，听 class.com。
Lesson 17. Eradicate. Sponsor. Nomad. Formidable. Exacerbate. Measles. Syphilis. Elusive. Trickle. Centralize. Discourse. Espouse. Temperate. Assimilate. Handicap. Benighted. Wine. Complacent. Thrust. Outright. Nazism. Reshuffle. Repulse. Revert. Rivet. Boggle. Bereave. Pester. Squirm. Orgasm. Acoustics. Collaborate. Corpus. Cumbersome. Curtail. Tilt. Lobe. Loft. Malt. Doleful. Charitable. Forage. Forbear. Great. Laurel. Flippant. Lenient. Rake. Rasp. Intermittent. Devastate. Ignite. Inborn. Passage 1. The world's last known case of smallpox was reported in Somalia, the Horn of Africa, in October 1977. The victim was a young cook named Ali Mao Malin. His case became a landmark in medical history, for smallpox is the first communicable disease to ever be eradicated. The campaign to free the world of smallpox has been led by the World Health Organization, the Horn of Africa, embracing the Ogaden region of Ethiopia and Somalia, was one of the last few smallpox-ridden areas of the world when the WHO-sponsored smallpox eradication program got underway there in 1971. Many of the 25 million inhabitants, mostly farmers and nomads living in the wilderness of desert, bush, and mountains, already had smallpox. The problem of tracing the disease in such formidable country was exacerbated by the continuous warfare in the area. The program concentrated on an imaginative policy of search and containment. Vaccination was used to reduce the widespread incidence of the disease, but the success of the campaign depended on the work of the volunteers. These were men paid by the day who walked hundreds of miles in search of rumors, information about possible smallpox cases. Often these rumors turned out to be a case of measles, chickenpox, or syphilis, but nothing could be left to chance. As the program progressed, the disease was gradually brought under control. By September 1976, the SEP made its first report that no new cases had been reported. But that first optimism was short-lived. A three-year-old girl called Amina Salat, from a dusty village in the Ogaden region of the southeast of Ethiopia, had given smallpox to a young nomad visitor. Leaving the village, the nomad had walked across the border into Somalia. There he infected 3,000 people, and among them had been the cook, Ali. It was further 14 months before the elusive Target Zero, no further cases, was reached. Even now, the search continues in high-risk areas and in parts of the country unchecked for some time. The flow of rumors has diminished to a trickle, but each must still be checked by a qualified person. Victory is in sight, but 2 years must pass since the last case before an international declaration that the world's entirely free from smallpox. Passage 2. David Landis, author of The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, Why Some Are So Rich and Some Are So Poor, credits the world's economic and social progress over the last 1,000 years to Western civilization and its dissemination. The reason, he believes, is that Europeans invented systematic economic developments. Landis argues that 3 unique aspects of European culture were crucial ingredients in Europe's economic growth. First, science developed as an autonomous method of intellectual inquiry that successfully disengaged itself from the social constraints of organized religion and from the political constraints of centralized authority. Though Europe lacked a political center, its scholars benefited from the use of a single vehicle of communication, Latin. This common tongue facilitated an adversarial discourse in which new ideas about the physical world could be tested, demonstrated, and then accepted across the continent and eventually across the world. Second, Landis exposed a generalized form of Max Weber's thesis that the values of work, initiative, and investment made the difference for Europe. Despite his emphasis on science, Landis does not stress the notion of rationality as such. In his view, what counts is work, thrift, honesty, patience, and tenacity. The only route to economic success for individuals or states is working hard, spending less than you earn, and investing the rest in productive capacity. This is the fundamental explanation of the problem posed by his book's subtitle, Why Some Are So Rich and Some Are So Poor. For historical reasons, an emphasis on private property, an experience of political pluralism, and a temperate climate and an urban style, Europeans have, on balance, followed most of those practices and therefore have prospered. Third, and perhaps most important, Europeans were learners. They learned rather greedily, as Joel Mocker put it in a review of Landis's book. Even if Europeans possessed indigenous technologies that gave them an advantage, spectacles, for example, as Landis believes they did, their most vital asset was the ability to assimilate knowledge from around the world and put it to use, as in borrowing the concept of zero, and rediscovering Aristotle's logic from the Arabs, taking paper and gunpowder from the Chinese via the Muslim world. Landis argues that a systematic resistance to learning from other cultures had become the greatest handicap of the Chinese by the 18th century and remains the greatest handicap of Arab countries today. Although his analysis of European expansion is almost non-existent, Landis does not argue that Europeans were beneficent bearers of civilization to a benighted world. Rather, he relies on his own common sense law. When one group is strong enough to push another around, it stands to gain by it, it will do so. In contrast to the new school of world historians, Landis believed that specific cultural values enabled technological advances that in turn made some Europeans strong enough to dominate people in other parts of the world. Europeans therefore proceeded to do so with great viciousness and cruelty. By focusing on their victimization in this process, Landis holds some post-colonial estates have wasted energy that could have been put into productive work and investment. If one could sum up Landis's advice to these states in one sentence, it might be, stop whining and get to work. This is particularly important, indeed hopeful advice, he would argue, because success is not permanent. Advantages are not fixed. Gains from trade are unequal, and different societies react differently to market signals. Therefore, not only is there a hope for undeveloped countries, but developed countries will have little cause to be complacent because the current situation will press hard on them. The thrust of studies like Landis's is to identify those distinctive features of European civilization that lie behind Europe's rise to power and the creation of modernity more generally. Other historians have placed a greater emphasis on such features as liberty, individualism, and Christianity. In a review essay, the art historian Craig Clunas listed some of the less well-known linkages that have been proposed between Western cultures and modernity, including the propensities to think quantitatively, enjoy pornography, and consume sugar. All such proposals assume the fundamental aptness of the question, what elements of European civilization led to European success? It is a short leap from this assumption to outright triumphalism. The paradigmatic book of this school is, of course, The End of History and the Last Man, in which Francis Fukuyama argues that after the collapse of Nazism and communism in the 20th century, the only remaining model for human organization as the industrial and communication ages is a combination of market economics and limited pluralist democratic government.